This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Let's talk about women and communism and why is there such a link there, especially in America? Let's talk to Megan Basham about the terrible, terrible tragedy in Charlotte. Let's talk to Florida's Surgeon General. They're doing great things down there. All that and more coming up on I'm Right. Okay, let's have an uncomfortable and undoubtedly offensive conversation about women and communism and the link there and why we're seeing the things we're seeing, not just in American society, but throughout history. But we're going to focus here on America because this is my home at the time. NBC just released a poll. You've probably seen it or heard about it. If not, they were surveying younger people. Gen Z is what they called it. And there is a lot you could take away from it, but one glaring thing when comparing Trump-voting men versus Harris-voting women was this. Men, the most important issue, having kids, continuing on the legacy. The least important issue for Kamala Harris-voting women was being married and having children. The most important thing for them was a job and money. A job and money. So let's talk about what has happened and why it has happened. And first, let's begin with the building blocks, the necessary building blocks of every single society, not just today, throughout history and forever in the future. If you want a good, solid society, I don't have to even think about American politics, left, right, Democrat, Republican, taxes, border. I don't have to think about anything. If there are solid nuclear family units that make up the majority of that society, it will be a good society. It will be solid. It will have problems like any other society will. I mean, some things are out of your control, some things aren't, but a solid society of husbands, wives, being together, staying together, having babies, raising those babies will be a society that will be good, it will be long-lasting, it will be stable, it will be clean, I don't have to know anything else. If you told me that, hey, Jesse, this is a society and 80% of the people come from solid nuclear families, it's going to be a good society. And vice versa. If there is a society where that number is 20%, 30%. Homes are broken. Children fatherless, motherless. I don't have to know anything else. I don't have to know who the president is, taxes. I don't need to know anything else. That society will be a disaster. A mixed up disaster of a society. That's how we are created. Again, I want to stress, if any of this is offensive to you, I couldn't possibly care less. These are facts. Now, let's get to the United States of America. The United States of America had a Christian founding. It was Christians who founded the United States of America in search of a better life, religious freedom, all those things, and various different forms of Christianity, you know, Quakers and Puritans. It really differed from state to state, but either way, it was all kind of a Christian society. And off of that Christian society, we had a society that was full of solid nuclear families. Dad, mom, kids. Dad, mom, kids. Over and over and over and over and over again. And what that created was a strong, morally good, independent-minded country. You know, families, good families, they end up in good communities. Good communities create good states. You get the idea. The building blocks are the family. Now, let's say you're a communist revolutionary and your goal is the breakup and destruction of the United States of America. Well, there are many, many, many different things you can do to bring that about, open borders, all kinds of things. But if you're tearing down a building, let's say it's a 20-story building, and you want to bring the whole building down, do you set your explosives on the top floor or do you set them on the foundation? You set them on the foundation. What's the foundation of our country, of any good country, the nuclear family? Communists know this. So the goal has always and will always be the destruction, the breakup of the nuclear family in the United States of America. And to that end, communists have tried to find a way to facilitate that breakup, a way to break the family down, a way to set those explosive charges on the foundation. And like all communist societies, they have found women to be the easiest route to breaking up the family. Now let's discuss this, lest you think I'm just being misogynist, Jesse, and dogging on women. That's not the case at all. Why is it women? Why are they the route to it? I mean, communists, the Soviet Union talked about this. In Cambodia, the most vicious were the women. Why is that the case? Are women uniquely evil? Are they stupid? No. Women are mothers. Even ones who aren't. I'm not saying you have children. Women are created with a motherly nature to them. They want to care for babies. No. Care for them. Nurture them. Raise them up. Care for smaller, weaker things. It is a woman's nature. She is created that way. That's why they're better nurses. That's why they're better homemakers. That's they're created that way. They're better than that. They're better than men at that. That's what they're created for. So the communist, he takes advantage of women using two things in combination. First, they're more inclined to be afraid of social embarrassment. They're more people-pleasing. You know, and this creates a wonderful dynamic in a home. If we're going out, I'm more inclined to say something inappropriate or do something wrong. And my wife, Aubrey, is more inclined to say, hey, Jesse, you can't make that joke. Hey, don't embarrass me. Does that mean she's wrong and I'm right? Or I'm wrong and she's right? No, it's a nice combination, right? Keeps everyone in line. But when they are young, single, developing minds, the communist takes that desire for social acceptance combined with her motherly nature and twists it into this. She becomes the mother of his cause, whatever that cause may be. She becomes the mother, and she's shamed into becoming that mother. Hey, you know, you don't need no man. Hey, you know what? These immigrants, they are all refugees. Shouldn't you care for them? Don't you? Look, that criminal, that violent criminal, shouldn't he be loved too? He needs help. Over and over and over again, the university system beats this into the head of that 18-year-old girl you loved and raised, and that's why 2 years later you get her back and she's a 300-pound lesbian with her head shaved who hates your freaking guts and denies the existence of God. They take her motherly nature and her desire for social acceptance and they twist it up and she becomes the mother of his cause. Soon, your 18, 19, 20-year-old daughter, instead of a strong desire for husband, for children, to nurture, to love a family, instead, she wants to be a lawyer. That's the most important thing. She wants a nice fat bank account. She wants a Rolls Royce. These become the things that are her priority. And what's the end result of that? The end result of that is, oh, she may end up making a great living, but men don't want that. Certainly not the good ones. That's not what men are looking for. It's not that men don't want a woman with a career. I'm certainly not saying that at all, but that's not what men are looking for, a woman who prioritizes money, her career. So the men, they don't marry her. Now, that brings us full circle to what we talked about in the very beginning. That destroys families because the family never exists. Young men, young women, now that they are separate, completely separate value systems, now they don't come together, get married, stay married, and make babies. Now that solid footing, the solid foundation of any society, the nuclear family, has been effectively demolished. Now the men want wives, they want children. The women want money. The women want jobs. And the net effect of this, of course, is the destruction of our society. If you asked me how wonderful our prospects are for the future, Jesse, where do you think we'll be in 50 years? I only need one metric, only one. I don't need to know how politics will go in the next 50 years, what Congress is going to do, who the president's going to be. I don't need to know about the border or taxes. I don't need to know any of those things. I need you to tell me, if you want me to tell you our prospects, in 50 years, what are the marriage statistics in the United States of America? Are young men marrying young women, staying married, and making babies? If they are, we're going to be just fine. And if they're not, this country will end. The communists is well aware of this. Well aware of this fact. And that's why I want to leave you, before we go on talk to Megan Basham about crime and other things, that's why I want to leave you with this little bit. This is for parents of daughters. Not that you don't have to look out for your young men. Believe me, you have to look out for your young men. If he marries a communist, he will turn into one. Be very careful. But your daughter, I know that you love her, and I know that you've raised her with values. Of course you do. You love your baby girl. And we think she's going to be okay. 18 years. Taught her right from wrong. We had her in church. She's baptized. 18 years. She's going to be just fine. Don't think that your 18-year-old girl doesn't need your protection anymore. Not just physical protection. The communists are circling her like wolves. And when you send your baby girl off to college or off to Instagram, those wolves are going to descend on her, and they are going to attempt to destroy her soul in an effort to destroy the country they hate the most. And you may soon lose your daughter. She may soon become a foot soldier in the war against the United States of America, her motherly instincts twisted up as she marches forward as a demon. Guard your daughters closely, very, very closely, and be very, very careful where you send that 18-year-old wonderful girl you raised off to school. All that may have made you uncomfortable, but I am right. We're going to talk to Megan Basham about many, many things, including this stuff in a moment. She's wonderful on this stuff. Before we do that, maybe you're sitting there thinking, well, I can't tell her no. She's always wanted to go to Berkeley. Jesse, she got in. I can't tell her no. I understand what you're going through. Low testosterone. That is your problem. If you can't tell your daughter no, then your T levels are low. But don't think that makes you unique. The United States of America has lost 50% of its testosterone in the last 50 years. That's why we have a society of effeminate men who can't say the word no to anybody, not to their wives, not to their daughters, not to anything at all. I'm too scared. Let Chuck turn you into what you should be, a strong man. Male Vitality Stack from Chuck, natural herbal supplements, will have your testosterone levels up 20% in 90 days. You are about to feel like how you should feel. 90 days. Give me 90 days and your whole life will be better. Chuck.com/JesseTV. We'll be back. All right, so we're on day two of talking about this freaking horrible story out of Charlotte and this young woman butchered by this animal on a train, and it's awful, and you're sad, and you're angry, and so am I. It's freaking terrible. There's no way to change that, but I want to make sure I remind you that the communist is not sad. If he's angry about anything, he's angry that his evil plans to release violent animals onto the streets are being revealed, courtesy of videotape, courtesy of social media. I mean, Brian Stelter went on CNN. Listen to what he's mad about.
This story has trickled up from local news to social media and now to the president's attention. And it's being used, as you said, Brianna, as a political symbol, with MAGA media calling for more forceful punishments and more incarceration. I have to say, some of the replies to Musk, some of the comments around this story are baldly racist, stoking fear of African Americans because this man attacked a white woman. The open racism on sites like X today, it's eye-popping.
We found the true evil in all this. Joining me now, Megan Basham, author of the wonderful book, Shepherds for Sale. If you want to know why your church is run by a bunch of skinny jeans wearing losers who tell you that gay marriage is okay, I would highly recommend you pick up that book. Megan, okay, you live in the Charlotte area. What's been the reaction locally?
Yeah, I do. And as you can imagine, there's been just a lot of shock, horror, anger about what's happened here. And, you know, something I always want to emphasize for people is that this was not a dangerous area of town where Irina Zarutska was killed. It's actually a very sort of trendy, fun shopping area, lots of restaurants. My family and I go there frequently. So it's not like she was in a bad part of town where this happened. So, you know, just really devastation. But an important element is I think a lot of people now are asking about the policies that allowed DeCarlos Brown to be on the streets and commit this murder, because this is certainly somebody who should have been behind bars.
You wrote a wonderful piece for the Daily Wire talking about racial equity policies and how they made this possible. What are you talking about?
Yeah, so, you know, it's funny that you played that Brian Stelter clip there, because they don't want to make race an issue here, but you can't separate racial politics from what happened in this incident, because quite frankly, racial equity policies are what led to DeCarlos Brown being on the streets. So back in 2020, our then Attorney General, Josh Stein, who is now the governor, at the directive of our then Democrat Governor Roy Cooper, initiated a racial equity task force in response to George Floyd's death. And so part of the policies that came out of that task force were increasing pretrial release, which is exactly what DeCarlos Brown had, even though he had faced 14 prior arrests, including for armed robbery, assault with a deadly weapon. So he was a known violent threat. And yet, because of these pretrial release policies, he was out on the streets. This racial equity task force also implemented decriminalizing homelessness and what they called public behavior, by which, you know, they essentially just mean when you see these people being a public menace on the street, they want to decriminalize that so that you're allowed to live on the street, you're allowed to harass people on the street. So that's what these quote unquote racial equity policies have been pursuing. And then on top of that, you know, since I published this story yesterday, I also discovered that the very large, very wealthy left-wing MacArthur Foundation gave Mecklenburg County, which Charlotte is a part of, $3.3 million as part of an initiative to reduce the jail population. So what they're really trying to do is ensure that people aren't jailed. And they, again, they're doing this in the name of racial equity. So you cannot separate these two issues. And so that's why you see people like Brian Stelter, CNN, so very eager not to talk about those particular policies that they promoted after George Floyd's death, that is a part of DEI, that is a part of that Black Lives Matter push to decriminalize behaviors that would have kept DeCarlos Brown behind bars, and to ensure that when they are arrested, they're not kept in jail until they face a judge, that they're allowed to just go free on a written letter of saying they'll appear before the court.
Grief. You say this is a trendy area of Charlotte. I love Charlotte. They have my favorite airport in the country. Have you noticed a degradation of the city? Is this, I don't live there. Is it noticeable? I'll tell you, in several cities I go to, New York City in particular, it's every year you go, it's crappier than it was the year before. You've seen this in Charlotte?
Yeah, you are. And, you know, we moved here in 2016. And at that point, you really never saw panhandlers, homeless on the street. And just in the last couple of years, as these policies have started to be implemented, I have started to notice, oh gosh, I don't feel quite as safe in some of these uptown neighborhoods as I once did. And I'm not the only one. I mean, I have friends who, I just spoke to somebody in Raleigh who told me, you know, he has a neighbor who is a schizophrenic, who has been visited several times by the police, just all kinds of, you know, horrible knife wielding. And this guy is never arrested. He's never taken into custody. So you have people who are being terrorized by their neighbors because of these policies. And look, we can also show this in hard numbers. I can give you my experience, and that has been my experience. But I can also show you that in 2024, Charlotte's homicide rate was up 25%. So that was the second highest year on record. The highest year on record was 2020 during the Black Lives Matter riots. Our just violent crime overall is up nearly 10%. Shootings into occupied homes is up 42%. So, you know, we're experiencing this on a personal level, and we're also seeing it at a statistical level.
Megan, I remember like it was yesterday after St. George Floyd died, losing the church we'd gone to for years because my effeminate pastor got up and scolded everybody about their white privilege. And he was certainly not alone. That happened over and over and over again back in 2020. What have those big pastors been saying now in the wake of this? Anything?
I'm so glad you asked that question, Jesse, because no, they're not. I'll give you a couple of examples right here in North Carolina. If you know who Stephen Furtick is, he's kind of a popular, I would call him a prosperity gospel preacher. He's extremely well known all over the country, kind of a young Joel Osteen. He was extremely vocal after the death of George Floyd, calling for reforms to our policing system. He has said nothing about the death of Irina Zarutska, even though he had a lot to say about George Floyd, who was in another state. Another example is the former president of the Southern Baptist Convention, which is the largest Protestant denomination in the U.S., extremely influential, a pastor named J.D. Greer. When he was president of the Southern Baptist Convention, he urged evangelicals to use the slogan Black Lives Matter. He said that we need to support their efforts to reform allegedly racist policing systems. And so they gave aid and comfort to these very policies that have now been enacted that resulted in the death of Irina Zarutska on that light rail train. And so, no, they have had nothing to say, even though this death, this murder, which is obviously extremely high profile, is right in their own backyard. They're not addressing that at all. And I think it's because they know, look, they played a part in this. They played a part in this by erroneously insisting that George Floyd's death was somehow an indictment of the policing system and not an indictment of his own drug habit. And because of this, they know that, look, we helped give aid and comfort to policies that are now making our cities unsafe.
Megan, before I let you go, how's your health? I know you've been going through it.
Thanks for asking, Jesse. It's good. So for those who don't know, and many I'm sure don't, I was diagnosed with stage 3 colon cancer around Thanksgiving last year. And as of a little over a month ago, I've been declared no evidence of disease. So feeling good, putting weight back on, and just praying for no recurrence.
God is good.
Yeah.
Thank you, ma'am. All right. Let's talk to Florida's Surgeon General, Dr. Joseph Lopato. He's been out there spearheading so many things. He's even promoting some really kooky things like exercise. Let's talk to him in a moment. Before we talk to him, I want to remind you that back in 2020, when the street animals were burning through the United States of America in the wake of the death of St. George Floyd, that America's corporations sponsored the entire thing. Black Lives Matter got big and national and powerful because it had corporate sponsorship. And if you have Verizon, AT&T, or T-Mobile, you paid for it. Corporate America is involved. Are you helping them? I'm not. My mobile company is Pure Talk. If they give back, and they do, they're sending flags to veterans, helping them back on their feet, get medical care. My cell phone company hires Americans. They're so patriotic. When you get a hold of people at Pure Talk, they speak English. I know it's almost jarring, and they're nice, and they'll save you money. Switch to Pure Talk. Don't pay for the destruction of your country. PureTalk.com/JesseTV. We'll be back.
The Florida Department of Health, in partnership with the governor, is going to be working to end all vaccine mandates in Florida law. All of them. All of them. All of them. Every last one of them. Every last one of them is wrong and drips with disdain and slavery. Okay? Who am I as a government, or anyone else, or who am I as a man standing here now to tell you what you should put in your body? Your body is a gift from God. What you put into your body is because of your relationship with your body and your God. I don't have that right. Government does not have that right.
It's wild to hear people speak like that with courage. Anyway, joining me now, the Surgeon General of Florida, Dr. Joseph Latipo. Hey, doctor, why are you banning people from getting vaccines?
We're actually going to get rid of all the vaccines in the state. We're going to hide them in a cave. No one will ever be able to get another vaccine in the state of Florida. That's the plan. Don't tell anyone. Yeah, so, you know, always say they're all available. They're all going to be available. All of the standard vaccines. I'm not talking about mRNA here. That's a special case. But they're available. We're just talking about, you know, letting parents choose. I mean, it's who knew that the idea that parents know best for their children when it comes to, you know, the medications they receive was such a controversial topic.
Doctor, can you explain how we got to a place in America where this is even remotely controversial, that parents should be able to decide, that people are against mandates? It's just wild for me as a free American who very much values that freedom to see so many Americans hate it.
It's really sad. And it reminds me, I'll tell you, Jesse, I didn't know, you know, when I was a kid, we had that Presidential Fitness Award. And I remember being excited about that, and, you know, doing pull-ups and push-ups and other things. I didn't know it went away. And with President Trump trying to bring it back, you have this, I was reading this article in the New York Times about how experts were worried that it could hurt the feelings of children or something. And that's, it's the answer to that question, that we could be so ridiculous as to feel like we have to protect children from, you know, aiming for physical fitness goals, is the same answer to the question of how we are, you know, it's controversial to push back on the notion that the government, rather than a parent, decides what vaccines a child takes. So it's all part of the same, you know, corrupted, sordid energy and entity. And it's so important that we push back. If it wasn't present, all that his nonsense we saw during COVID would not have been possible. But sadly, it was possible because that's where we are right now.
Is this about money? Does this come down to, I mean, look, everyone has their own opinion on this thing, but let's sift through that. Is this just simply about money? You know, is this pharma money? What are all these mandates about people making money?
Yeah, money's a part of it. And pharma definitely is intimidated by the notion that they lose the leverage of that, of a mandate. They're definitely, that will have a big deal for their bottom line. And they definitely care about that. But, you know, among physicians, I mean, it's really about, it's like about religion. Aaron Seary, who's an amazing, brilliant, brilliant attorney, just wrote this book, and I think it's titled Vaccines Amen. And for physicians and scientists, many of them, that's what it's about. And that's, you know, that's harder to navigate.
I've seen you multiple times promote this kooky idea about exercise. You want to explain that?
I know it's a really foreign concept to apparently, if you go to medical school or get a PhD, you forget how important these things are. But yeah, man, it's like, it's so important, right? It's really important to take care of our bodies as well as we can. And it affects your immune system. You know, it affects your mood, it affects your energy, it affects your susceptibility to illness and disease. So it affects your susceptibility to cancer. So it's really important.
You have been a hardliner on the mRNA stuff. It seems as if a lot of this thinking is starting to bleed over into the federal government, CDC. Do you like the things you're seeing from the feds?
I do. And, you know, Robert F. Kennedy is a, you know, he's a good friend of mine, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, Dr. Marty McCary, Martin McCary, and Dr. Oz, too. You know, great guys, great doctors. And, you know, and they're up against a lot. You know, this stuff, like this, we didn't get to where we are overnight. You know, this is very, very, very entrenched, the things that they are up against. But, you know, they're working through it, and, you know, God bless them for doing it. And I know people also complain, and God bless them for complaining too. You know, if people don't like things that are happening, just it's important that they express it. And but I also know that those guys are doing the best that they can.
Doctor, the trust the public puts in organizations like the CDC has been shattered, possibly permanently. How do we get it back?
Well, one way, one step of that is to let go of mandates, because that's a major part of distrust that we saw over the last few years. But it's going to be hard, man. They have, you know, when these guys, when Dr. Linares, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing her name, but their former director and their other senior leadership resigned, they had this rally, I think, the next day. And, you know, they are really, really, they're like cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs when it comes to the vaccines. It's just like, they're very intelligent people, obviously. But you just like, you put the vaccine chip in there and they just can't think straight anymore. So that's hard to overcome. It's very hard to overcome. But the right leadership, and it's hard, because you need both the strong scientific background, but you also need the character, like someone who can lead, someone who inspires and rouses people out of whatever state they are and orients them toward a state that they intrinsically feel is better and more meritorious. So it's going to be hard, because it's hard to find that type of individual, but I think that's what it's going to take.
Doctor, I appreciate you very much. Keep doing what you do. Let's find out what's going on in the Supreme Court. We have good news next. It appears that Trump got another couple wins at the Supreme Court, but as I've explained to you before, whenever there's a court decision of any kind, Supreme, lower courts, and you get up and you look at your phone and you see this decision, don't write it in concrete just yet. Okay, take it all with a grain of salt. There are decisions that get way deeper than the headlines, that go back and forth. Don't ever get too excited, and don't ever go jump off a bridge when there's a decision you love or a decision you hate. We have to work through these things by talking to smart people. That's why we bring Josh Hammer on the show, host of The Josh Hammer Show. Okay, Josh, I see headlines, and it looks like Trump got a couple nice wins, including allowing ICE agents to keep arresting people. Focus on that. What's the backstory? What happened?
Yeah, so Jesse, you know, in this case, I think the headline matches the reality, is that these are a couple of nice wins for the Trump administration. So first, there is this immigration enforcement case that comes out of Los Angeles, one of America's most infamous so-called sanctuary cities. And they basically say that the Trump administration is correctly enforcing immigration law when they are sending in ICE agents to engage in so-called raids, you know, aka trying to deport illegal aliens, people who should not be here illegally, which last I checked is in line with the mandate that President Trump got at the ballot box last November. This is exactly what people voted for. And there's a very interesting concurring opinion from Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who basically says, you know what? There are some administrations that go very light on enforcing immigration law. I don't know, maybe the Barack Obama administration or the Joe Biden administration. And then there are some administrations that are a bit tougher on enforcing immigration law. That would be the Trump administration. What Brett Kavanaugh, I think, very correctly and astutely says is that, you know what? It's not up to us. It's not up to us as judges to make these policy determinations as to just how rigorous immigration law ought to be enforced. That is a political decision for the voters, for the American people. I actually would frankly go, Jesse, a little further than that. There's an interesting clause in Article 2 of the Constitution called the take care clause. It basically says that the president shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. I have long interpreted, going back to my law school days, I have long interpreted the take care clause to mean that the president does have an obligation jurisdiction to, in his best efforts, to enforce all the laws. Now, this gets a little tricky because there is such thing as prosecutorial discretion. You simply cannot prosecute every single crime in the country. There's literally not enough money or manpower. Fine, that's a reality in every prosecution office there. But you can't just let some laws just nakedly go unenforced. That's how you get Barack Obama's DACA and DAPA amnesties back from 10 to 12 years ago or so there. So anyway, it's a good opinion there. It's a very nice win when it comes to immigration enforcement. It's a solid win for the administration.
Okay. Surprise, surprise. Sotomayor was unhappy with this whole thing. I find the mind of the communist to be fascinating. What exactly is her worldview on all this?
Okay, so if you go into the Supreme Court and really the federal courts more generally, if you look at what they've said when it comes to how the presidency can go about enforcing immigration law, first of all, Jesse, I should probably note, I kind of object to this on a level of principle. I do not think that the courts should be engaged in this level of nitpicking as to how the executive branch, how ICE, how DHS goes about enforcing immigration laws. You know, judges should stick to judging there and let the political branches do what they do. Nonetheless, the courts have weighed in a lot over the years when it comes to how immigration law can be enforced. And what they basically say is that they have the ability to go into certain workplaces, focus on certain industries where there are disproportionately going to be folks who are not here legally, whether that is landscaping or construction or agriculture, things like that. And furthermore, they also say that it is okay to focus disproportionately on areas where there is not a lot of English being spoken. What they also say is that it is illegal, it's unconstitutional to explicitly racially profile. So they draw the line somewhere between a preponderance of people not speaking English on the one hand, which they say is okay, you can have ICE agents focus there. On the other hand, they say that if you're just picking out basically a bunch of brown people, then it's not okay to focus there. So look, if we're trying to be charitable, which I don't really want to be to Sonia Sotomayor, but if we're trying to be charitable, that's what she's saying. She's basically saying that the Trump administration, ICE, is focusing not just on all the factors that I said that you're allowed to focus on, but they're actually focusing really just on brown people. Again, I don't buy this for a second, to be honest with you. I think it's ludicrous, frankly, that the courts are involved in this kind of process in the first place. But that's in theory, Jesse. If we're trying to steel man the argument, so if you're trying to give the best impression of her argument, that's in theory what she's trying to say. But really, she's just a communist, as you said.
Josh, what does this mean as far as ICE in places like Chicago? Obviously, Chicago has been all over the news. We're sending in the National Guard. Does this mean the Trump administration can move forward sending ICE anywhere they please? Or are there little limitations in this ruling like there always seem to be?
Look, I mean, lawyers like to lawyer, Jesse. So there's always going to be some kind of legally, lawyerly limits there. I mean... Yes, but also only to a point. I mean, this does, I think, pave the way nicely for the Trump administration to start deploying ICE, DHS. But the National Guard is a slightly different legal analysis, but potentially also even the National Guard. You know, speaking of Los Angeles, let's not forget that the National Guard was just in Los Angeles in June. There wasn't a specifically deportation-oriented mission back then. It was really just trying to quell anarchy, but the anarchy was immigration-related, so it's kind of all related to one another. But yeah, Chicago is very much in the crosshairs. Just over the past 24 hours, it looks like Operation Midway Blitz has started, which is an immigration enforcement operation centered around Brandon Johnson's city of Chicago, perhaps all throughout J.B. Pritzker's state of Illinois. Look, Jesse, as a former Chicagoan myself who has been very sad to see that city go tremendously downhill over the past decade, and it was already pretty bad, frankly, when I was living there, it's gone a heck of a lot more downhill since then. I say all hands on deck. If Donald Trump wants to clean up Chicago, I say two big fat thumbs up. There's a long way to go. It is a serious challenge, but it's a world-class city that should be made great once again, I think.
Okay, let's focus on the other one. Donald Trump removing a Democrat member of the Federal Trade Commission. How in the world did this even end up on the Supreme Court? What happened?
So the FTC is one of these quasi-independent agencies there where you have Congress that statutorily legislates, where there has to be a certain partisan mix of Republican commissioners, Democrat commissioners. Basically, it is structured differently. The FTC, the FCC, the National Labor Relations Board, there's a lot of these agencies that really kind of go back to the early part of the 20th century, especially the FDR era, the New Deal. A lot of these agencies are structured differently as a constitutional and statutory matter from kind of the big iconic agencies that people are familiar with, you know, call it the DOJ, Treasury, so forth there. Now, the big legal fight that's going on here is what is the extent of the president's executive power to engage in removal decisions, to actually engage in hiring and firing personnel decisions, that is, when it comes to all agencies, whether they call themselves independent or not, within Article 2 of the Constitution. My very simple, straightforward legal analysis, I've been saying this for 20 years now, I guess, is that the executive power of Article 2, if it means literally anything whatsoever, it means the ability to control who is in your executive branch. That, after all, is what defines you as the chief executive of the executive branch. So unless you are responsible for all hiring and firing decisions, you are not actually the executive wielding the executive power as Article 2, Section 1, Clause 1 calls for. Now, the alternative argument, which is essentially an FDR New Deal Democrat argument, is that no, Congress can actually legislate certain limits on the president's removal power there. All of this is teeing up potentially a direct challenge to a very problematic case from the very height of the New Deal, a 1935 case called Humphrey's Executor, which was one of the more infamous decisions of that era, where they basically said that congressional limitations on the president's removal power for these independent agencies is actually okay. It actually is constitutional. There's been a lot of chipping away at that, including a National Labor Relations Board case earlier this term called Gwynne versus Wilcox, which is another win for Trump, very similar context there, firing a Biden-nominated member, Gwynne Wilcox of the NLRB. So between NLRB and Wilcox and now the FTC in this particular case, I think we're kind of gearing up for a direct challenge to this case, Humphrey's Executor, and I say, frankly, it's long overdue.
All right, let's shift gears and talk about trade, specifically tariff refunds. Anyway, here was Scott Bessent.
If the Supreme Court rules against you on these tariffs, is the administration prepared to offer rebates?
Kristen, I am confident that we will win at the Supreme Court, but there are numerous other avenues that we can take. They diminish President Trump's negotiating position, but there are numerous in terms of, and remember, this isn't about the dollars, this is about balance. The dollars are an after amount.
Would you offer rebates, though? Are you prepared to offer rebates?
So we would have to give a refund on about half the tariffs, which would be terrible for the Treasury.
And you're prepared to give those refunds?
Well, I mean, there's no be prepared. If the court says it, we'd have to.
Josh, what?
Jesse, look, I wish I could say that I share Scott Bessent's confidence when it comes to the Supreme Court outcome. I don't. I'm not predicting a loss, but I'm not predicting a win either. I genuinely actually am not sure which way this one is going to go. If you look at the legal ruling from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, which was the court that had the Court of Appeals ruling just about a week or two ago, whenever it was, They wrote it in very kind of formalistic, legalistic, we might even call it a quasi-originalist form of analysis there, clearly trying to appeal to Brett Kavanaugh, to Amy Coney Barrett, John Roberts, to the court's swing justice. You know, which way they will ultimately decide, I don't actually know. I mean, the ultimate legal question here is the balance of trade or America's gargantuan trade deficit year in and year out the kind of quote-unquote emergency that would allow the president to invoke this sort of emergency authority there? I think it's a very interesting question. I see both sides' argument. I don't actually have a super, super strong stance on the matter. I'm inclined to think that the administration is probably correct there. I think Congress likely intended to delegate a lot of this to the executive branch there, but it's a very interesting, close legal argument. The easiest way to get this done, though, just to clarify, is for Congress to just pass a law. That is obviously the way that this should be done. Tariffs, raising revenue, Congress is the perfect body for that. Unfortunately, Jesse, as you and I both know, Congress is not good for a whole lot these days other than naming post offices and a bunch of cable news grandstanding.
Gosh, it's so friggin' true. Josh, thank you, brother. Come back soon. We have a wonderful light in the moon. Next. It's time to lighten the mood. Sports has been attacked by the right over and over again in recent years, most definitely by myself included, because sports, especially large sports organizations, have chosen to take part in the cultural destruction of the United States of America. There's no question about that. We've talked about it. But we should give credit where credit's due. It's not all sports. It's not all teams. It's not all players. There are still wonderful things happening in the sports arena that we should highlight when they happen. My favorite school, as everybody knows, is Ohio State University. I was born in Ohio, and Ohio State University, They just had an invitation to Jesus event. They're star players. You know, everybody wants to meet, hang out with the star players. Their star players had this event on campus. Over 75 people were baptized at this event. Sports does matter. Leadership does matter. And people seem to be waking up and discovering God again. And that, I hope, does your soul well. I'll see you tomorrow.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.